This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm delighted to be here tonight to launch the Origin Speaker Series in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee. This gathering is intended to elevate the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and growers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish, shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses, and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that farmers and producers are doing in our area. The conversation is being held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Tonight's conversation is about Maryland produce, who grows it, and who consumes it. And now I'd like to turn the program over to Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series.
I'm delighted that this is our second installment of the series, and it's just great to see everybody come out on our Siberian Express evening. It's been a very collaborative effort from the beginning. Obviously, I want to thank Spike and Amy for kind of giving us their wonderful home to have this conversation and continue to have these conversations. I want to additionally thank everybody at Food Shed, Corey, Audrey, Hannah, everybody on the staff here at Artifact tonight. And I want to thank our panelists. We have Holly Fresh Top, is that right? The director of,
Food Policy Director for
Baltimore City. We have Joan and Drew Norman. Where's Joan?
Oh my
gosh. The owners of Juan Straw Farm. And we have Cynthia Shea, who is the, let's see if I can get her title correct, the staff associate with the Food and Nutrition Services for Baltimore County Public Schools.
City.
City.
Sorry, what did I say?
City.
So let me just give you a little brief overview of their backgrounds, and then I'm going to turn it over to Vicki Hess, who's standing down at the end of the room. She'll be our facilitator for the evening. So I'll start with Holly. Holly is Baltimore City's first food policy director, and she began her work with the City of Baltimore in 2010. Holly takes food access seriously and works citywide with many government departments to align priorities and projects around improving the Baltimore City food environment. Recognizing that government can't address food access alone, Fresh Hut uses a multi-sector perspective and engages with many agencies, nonprofits, community groups, and stakeholders to dismantle policy barriers, facilitate new partnerships, and leverage funding to implement innovative solutions to address food access issues in the city. Fresh Chat has spent a decade working on food issues in a variety of contexts, experiences that have provided her with an understanding of the food system from the perspective of a nutritionist, an educator, and a farmer. Across the country, she has led and worked on projects that include agricultural marketing, farm to school, farm to healthcare, and sustainable livestock production. Fresh Chat has a Master of Science from Tufts University in Food Policy and Applied Nutrition, and was a Food and Society Policy Fellow from 2007 to 2009. Welcome, Holly.
Thanks.
Joan and her husband, Drew Norman, right here, so we have Joan here and Drew here, own One Straw Farm, a family-owned and operated vegetable farm located in Baltimore County, Maryland. They began farming in 1983 on 3 rented acres. They now farm over 200 growing acres, growing produce using organic methods and pasture-raised GMO-free pork. The work is divided up, so Drew is in charge of the farming, and Joan markets, sells, and does all the paperwork. One Straw Farm supports an 1,800-member community-supported agricultural program, complemented by sales to 5 Baltimore-area farmers markets, local restaurants, colleges, and wholesale distributors. 2015 will mark the beginning of their 32nd year of farming. Thank you, Joan and Drew. And a lot of the food you're going to be eating tonight comes from their farm. Cynthia Shea, over here. Cynthia, raise your hand. is a trained chef. She's a graduate of the Culinary Institute of America. She's the former restaurant manager of the San Francisco famed restaurant known as Zuni Cafe. She also owned for 10 years Soups On in Hampton. Sorry, that's not there anymore. and now she is the staff associate with Food and Nutrition, Baltimore County Public School.
City.
I live in the county. Cynthia manages all the fresh fruits and vegetables on the school's breakfast and lunch programs. She started the city school system in 2012, launching the Salad Bar Initiative that was part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move program. So welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Awesome. I'm going to be standing out here so I can sort of see you all, but this is not a conversation with me tonight. This is a conversation with the panelists and you. And I want to tell you how our format's going to work. I'm going to ask one of the panelists to speak for a few minutes. They're going to give you kind of an overview and some more information about them and the things that they work on. Then we're going to open it up for a couple of questions for that specific panelist. Then we'll move to a second panelist, a couple of questions, and you get the idea. Once everyone's had a chance to speak, then we'll just open up for a general dialogue. Remember that we're being recorded, so we'll be passing a mic to you to ask the question because we want all of our listeners to be able to hear your question as well. So, Holly, we're going to ask you to start first, please.
Great. Hi, everyone. So that was a very formal bio, the kind of bio I send for conferences around the country, not one in which I would talk to artifacts. So let's ignore that bio, and this is going to be more of a conversation. So, yes, I'm the food policy director for Baltimore City. What really is that? It's probably the question you're wondering. What is policy? Why do we need it in the city as it relates to food? So I will start with, I was so thrilled 5 years ago when I was looking at this job description. I was like, oh my God, Baltimore has a sustainability plan. Like within the sustainability plan, there's a whole goal on establish Baltimore as a leader in local sustainable food systems. I mean, that to me seemed unheard of. I mean, what a cool goal for Baltimore City, which you think of a dense city or a relatively dense city. You don't think of a goal in ag production, a goal in local farming, CSAs. And so what my job really is, I have two key things I do. One is looking at food access, because we have food access is a significant issue in our city. So a lot of my time is looking at why is food access a problem? Where is the food retail? Why is it not equal around healthy food access in the city? Why are supermarkets where they're located? Why are there so many corner stores and carryouts in other neighborhoods? Where are the gardens? Where are the farms? Lots of questions. Where's the transportation system? I only have 5 minutes. So I'm really just going to give you words so you can ask me a question later, then I'll answer it. So food access is one big piece. And then the whole other part is sustainability as it relates to food. I'm housed in the Department of Planning in the Office of Sustainability. And I'm really looking at farmers markets, CSAs, community-supported agriculture, and really how do we grow food in the city for city residents, and how do we get local food from the region into the city? This is just not me. It's a whole team of us, and we have so many partners because this is a really big goal, big objectives, and no one person can do this or agency. I'm going to plant my seeds right now. I'm sorry, my puns are as bad as everyone else's when it comes to food and growing, and I can't even help it anymore. All right, I'm looking at Joan because Joan and I work very closely together, and I would say one of the coolest programs in the country, in my biased opinion, which is we realized around 4 years ago when I became a city employee, official city employee, no longer grant-funded, and I was sitting in my orientation, and we were talking about my labor union and how I have a wellness incentive for $250. And it was for the gym, it was for eyeglasses, but there was nothing about food. And so I have to say, it's taken me a while, but 3.5 years later from that moment, we changed the policy in the city. It's for one labor union right now, but I'm working on multiple labor unions and now health insurance companies, where the wellness incentives, when there is a wellness incentive, we're allowing it for CSAs. Because you can belong to a gym doesn't mean you go to a gym. I am a perfect example of that right now. But also with my CSA, though, I ate my produce every week because it got delivered to my office. I mean, in my office. I couldn't avoid it. It was there, and I ate it because it was going to go bad in my fridge. And I'm an advocate. I mean, I'm like one of the great advocates, and I still needed it delivered to my office for it to work. We saw 80% of the CSA participants never belonged to a CSA before. And we saw increased fruit and vegetable consumption. And so that was 145 employees at Baltimore City in our first year of CSA. So that is really, really great. And it was a policy change. So a lot of the work I do is looking at the policy that can make other things happen. Farmers markets. In farmers markets, we're really looking at a SNAP, formerly known as food stamps. And I work most closely with the Baltimore Farmers Market and Bazaar, the really big one under the JFX that has 9,000 employees. I mean, sorry, 9,000 people on a given Sunday. Well, we realized in an assessment several years ago that there weren't a lot of low-income people there, and SNAP was not available. And so we started off with the token system, which many of you may know, and we thought it was so cool. But we realized quickly with 9,000 people and so many more people coming for SNAP, the farmers market turned into a bank, and they were counting tokens for 8 or 9 hours. So it was this great idea for SNAP, but it wasn't quite a farmer's market in that scale. So then we moved to every vendor now has a smartphone that is accepting SNAP. And so we were looking at the policy changes that the agency who is running this market needed to go through in order to make that happen. So that's another one. Sorry, I have to cheat in my notes the next part. Urban agriculture. We have an urban ag plan for the city. We have goals and objectives of how to have more growing of food, selling of food, and making it easy to have food procured in the city. And so we have a land leasing initiative where we have, I think, 3 farms so far leasing from the city in 5-year lease agreements. We now have water access to most community gardens. And then we also are working on some legislation, urban ag legislation, which is in process. We have the state enabling legislation, which is great. Now we're working with City Hall and Finance to really look at a tax incentive for urban farmers to farm on their land. I'm probably close to my 5-minute mark, so I think I'm going to stop right there.
So what questions do you have for Holly just from that brief introduction that we heard? I'm sure your mind is spinning right now. Who has a question?
The City Community Garden Program that you have.
Yeah.
How is that, the City Community Garden Program that you have, how is that being responded by the, I guess, the residents who are participating?
All right. So actually, a nonprofit runs all the community gardens for the city. So we don't actually run gardens, but we have a land leasing initiative for farms. So what we're really looking at is urban, is production of food. How do we grow farmers in the city? Then we have Parks and People Foundation and others who are really supporting community gardens. Now, one thing that we are doing as it relates, we have a zoning code, proposed zoning code, Transform Baltimore. And in that, we are trying to change, allow for community gardens if you want to have a farm stand, because everyone knows that once you start to grow, you have extra, and what do you do with it? You want to sell it. Well, that's part of what we're trying to do now, is to be able to grow food for yourself and your family, but also be able to sell it.
I have a question down here.
Hi. What are some of the other cities maybe around us or in America that are doing that you find some inspiration from that maybe we're trying to work towards, as an example?
Okay, I was so thrilled. I was in Cleveland for a conference, and we were driving on a freeway, and I saw sheep grazing, and they were grazing the land before development came in. And before they were using the sheep, and they were moving through the city and other livestock. And so that was one thing that I thought was really, really cool. Another was we have 6 public markets in Baltimore City. And in other public markets around the country, they actually have a farm or a rooftop garden or some way to grow your food, which I thought was also really cool. There's a lot. You can ask me that later.
So one more question, and then we're going to get to our next speaker. And don't worry, we will have time, so keep your questions in mind. We don't get
to an old
time.
Baltimore City tradition of there used to be horse-drawn food, you know, fresh
A-rabbers.
Yeah. Yeah, I know you're not supposed to say that, but it's as far as I can tell, no longer out there. Is there some way to? Is there anything left of that tradition that you can leverage to help get fresh produce to these communities?
Yeah. So there's 2 different questions in that, and I'll try to do it quickly. So with A-rabbers, I think to date there's 3 or 4 A-rabbers with horses right now. Many of them have moved into trucks. So A-rabbers right now in this current age are going, driving to Jessup, getting their produce, and then putting it on the horses. It was really interesting. We can have another conversation on just A-rabbing. And one thing that I would love to see is how do we get local food why can't they or could they go to Lexington Market one day when we have local food distribution back into the city, and could the ARABbers go there to pick up the produce, or even at Holland's Market because the stable's right next to it. So I think there could be a way to, for the ARABbers that are there right now to be able to actually procure produce and not have to drive all the way to Jessup for the food.
Thank you. Great question. So, Joan, we'd love to hear from you
all. It's kind of hard. Talking is my best sport, as I tell people frequently. My husband and I have been farming. This is our 32nd year. He's actually the farmer. I'm the one who does all the talking. Just in case you wanted to know that, too. But I said, I'm proud to tell you that I'm actually one of the members of the, or the, one of the group of the graduating, I said it wrong. I am a graduate of the Baltimore City School System. I sort of doubt at this point there's that many people around who are graduate of the Baltimore City School System selling back produce. Caught you. To Baltimore City. So part of the mission, people say, why do you do that? Well, Leanne, Baltimore City's my people. I mean, that's who we're meant to feed. So we, for years, sold wholesale in the organic, you know, wholesale market up and down the East Coast. And we were shipping to Texas and Chicago and New York and Boston. And my friends kept saying, well, where can we get your produce? And I'm like, well, you can't. And that was a problem. So that's when we decided, we had had one farmer's market, you could go there, but that's not really feeding everybody. So the CSA, we started in 1999. We started with 8 members. We now have 1,800. We have more than 45 different sites in the Baltimore metropolitan area. I counted quickly on the way down. I have 30 in Baltimore City. 2 of my 5 farmer's markets are in Baltimore City. So I think we feed restaurants in Baltimore City like Artifact and Woodbury Kitchen and Parts and Labor. We also have a program called Days of Taste that we do with the American Institute of Wine and Food, and Reva's here tonight. And they bring city school students in the 4th grade out to the farm. First the chefs come in and talk about the parts of their tongue and where's your food come from. Then they come visit a farm, and then the 3rd day the chefs come back and make a salad with the kids, and all of a sudden there's this enlightenment, like, oh, wow, that's where that came from. I always tell the kids they have to have 2 bites of every vegetable they meet from now on. I'm proud to tell you there has been young adults coming in saying, I still don't like mushrooms, but I've tried the lettuce, it's okay. So we're getting someplace. We now have the program with Holly with the city CSA, which is kind of exciting as well. That's a whole different sort of adventure. And imagine having your food be medicine and eating it first so you're not having to take the things at the end. So that's another project. Let's see what else. So I've gotten farmers markets. We have 2. We do the one at 32nd Street. We do the one in Fells Point. There's probably 15 restaurants in Baltimore. And then we do wholesale. So that's kind of our whole general group in a package. We're very committed to feeding Baltimore. They've asked us to go to D.C., and our goal really is to stay in Baltimore because there's plenty of people here and everybody wants to eat. It's just a matter of opening up the doors and getting into different places. And so we're willing to try things. If it works, then Holly called and said, you want to try this? I just said, absolutely. Let's start. So that's kind of been how we approach selling in Baltimore City and to your residents.
Thank you. So what questions do you have for Joan or Joan and Drew? Yes, I'm coming around with the microphone.
If you go to downtown Philadelphia, they have the the Amish market, the farmers market. Why can't we do something like that here? It's right in central Philadelphia, and anytime you go in there, it's mobbed. Is there possible that we can find a place that we can redo and do it like the Philadelphia farmers market?
I'm not sure that's a question for me, because I'm not a space issue. I'm the one who could grow it and bring it to you, and I'm not opposed to doing that at all. I'd be happy to discuss that, but the space is not my forte. You know,
Holly,
I'd say,
is that you?
Let's table that for the end.
Okay.
Oh, God, another one, sorry. And we can address that.
Okay, great. So another question for Joan or Joan and Drew?
I have
And then we have another one down here.
I have a question for regarding the weather. What do you do when it's like this? Because I know, Spike spends a lot of time preserving food during the growing season, so he has a supply during the year.
And you can ask him why he does that.
So, do you guys do anything that, or is it just what grows at what particular time of the year?
We actually do have some canning done. We have had tomatoes canned. We've made Bloody Mary mix that we make. We have a tomatillo salsa that you'll be trying tonight. I call that stalling the harvest. We grow things in the bulk of the time period because that's when it is. Growing it during the winter is another project, and it's kind of iffy. I have a son who's now interested in farming, thank goodness. And, you know, that's kind of nice when finally you have a next generation who doesn't say, hey, I need to get off the farm. He said, I looked around one day and said, I want to come back to the farm. So obviously we were doing okay if it looked interesting. And so we're going to explore that a little bit more about how to grow more during the winter in some of the hoop houses we have. It becomes a whole other job and another project, and you need another set of hands to kind of take that on. So in the winter, this kind of weather, you say very bad words. You probably are sitting and reading a book that you have put on the table for a long time. You're unfortunately looking at your tax papers and ordering seeds. That's kind of, it's this two-month period where
fixing
you slow down.
Stuff.
And fix things, right?
Okay, and we had a question here.
That's your job.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my question. I guess not what age, but at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to become passionate about farming? I have a desire to do it, but I have black thumbs. I'm currently a chef. That's what I've been doing as long as I can remember.
We love you.
But I wanted to know, because I want to do it, but I'm fearful. Like, what is going to happen? What will become of this? Because I live in a food desert. So I'm like, if I could do it, it would be amazing for my community.
So number one is, I did not ever grow up thinking I'd be a farmer or a farmer's wife. So I got kind of sucked in later in our marriage, about 15 years in. Now you can ask Drew, it would be his question, when did he want to be a farmer? Because I'm just part of the part that helps the dream come true. That's my job.
I always wanted to be a farmer. I grew up in the country, and I grew up next to a dairy farm. So when I was old enough to work, I started working on farms.
Thank you.
Nice. Thank you. All right. So we will come back if you have other
questions. I'm going to just make one comment to
this. Yes.
His father's a doctor. His father's a doctor at Hopkins. And his comment to him has always been, do what you love and do it well, and you will always be successful. So that's what you need to do.
Good advice. Good advice. Okay, so Cynthia, you are up next.
Wonderful. Thanks. I'm really happy to be here. I thought it'd be really important to start with just giving a background about what and who Baltimore City Public Schools reaches on a daily basis, because the numbers can be slightly overwhelming. So in Baltimore City Public Schools, we have approximately 84,000 students enrolled for the school year of 14-15. 84% of those students are eligible for free meals. Broken down, that means we potentially can serve 72,000 children for free for breakfast and lunch, which is 160,000 meals a day. And we prepare for that. So where produce comes in to that is actually really exciting, but also, as you can imagine, very overwhelming. The USDA meal patterns are very important, and I won't go into detail with them right now because I don't have time, but I'm happy to sort of break them down for anyone who's interested. But with the Healthy Hunger Kids Free Act, it became a requirement for any student that was getting a free meal that they had to take a fruit or vegetable. Before this act passed, fruits and vegetables were required to be offered, but not required to be taken. So because of that, obviously the goal was to increase fruits and vegetables that were being eaten by students. So not immediately, but as of right now, in Baltimore City, the Food and Nutrition Office is dedicated to offering those fruits and vegetables as fresh, as opposed to canned or frozen. So all fruits that are offered at breakfast and lunch are all fresh fruits. We no longer serve canned fruits. Now, if you're in a Baltimore City school, the day after a snow day, when the produce truck didn't get there, you might see some canned fruit. But that's the goal. And also vegetables. So we also serve many, many, many salads, and we do that a couple different ways. In 2010, Baltimore City was granted 10 salad bars from the Let's Move Salad Bars to Schools initiative, which is part of Michelle Obama's Let's Move program. From those 10 salad bars in 2010, we went to 70 salad bars in Baltimore City schools. And I should just backtrack a little and tell you guys that we have 192 cafeterias in Baltimore City Public Schools. So 70 of them have salad bars. And because of the success of the salad bars and because of the new requirements of everyone having to take a vegetable, we wanted to make it as attractive and good and healthy as possible. So what we did is, because of existing infrastructure and sort of, you know, all the issues that come with new equipment and new policies, we really sort of pared down the goal to, the goal isn't necessarily to serve a salad from a salad bar, the goal is to serve salad. So what we did was just take a step back and say, okay, if we can't fit a salad bar into a cafeteria, let's just make them a salad. So as of now, all 192 schools serve salad every day for lunch. This requires a lot of produce, as you can imagine. So one of the things we did, we had to step back and get a new contract with a purveyor that could deliver to 190 sites every week all over the city, that could provide us with all the produce that we need. So we also put as part of that contract that it had to be, if local produce was available, they are required to sell us that. Now, local for Baltimore City Public Schools is within a 200-mile radius, which is the most reasonable we could do, and this, in, you know, keeping in mind the scale and the scope of how much we need to purchase. So, as of this school year, or sorry, for last school year, we and this is just the local produce, which is basically fruit, fruit, cucumbers, and broccoli. It was 750,000 pounds, which is a lot of produce. And that all went to schools. We also, our strategies and implementation, we had to do a lot of work with updating our existing infrastructure since there were mostly canned and frozen products being served in the schools before 2 years ago. There were several schools that had inadequate refrigeration. They had was refrigerators for milk. They would serve 300 kids frozen and canned produce, you know, product, including the fruits and vegetables, and so there was no need for a refrigerator except to refrigerate milk. So we had to commit to, the district has committed over $1 million for basically just equipment. We also had to buy some smallwares. There were no knives and cutting boards in all these cafeterias. So I had to buy those, which was sort of a surprise to me coming from the restaurant business. We also had to really deal in terms of being, making this a successful policy and implementation, to retrain and re-educate our staff. We have an incredible staff. We Food and Nutrition employs over 750 Baltimore City residents, which is wonderful, many of whom have been with the district for over 15 years, but also many of whom were not familiar with product identification, ripeness of a piece of fruit, how it's stored, do pears go in the refrigerator, you know, etc. So we really had to sort of start from scratch on that. and I'm happy to elaborate on that as well. The other really exciting thing that we've done in Baltimore City that I think is truly amazing and commendable, makes me very proud, is that we work with Great Kids Farm, which is a part of Baltimore City Public Schools. And the relationship started with Great Kids Farm. Great Kids Farm was planting and harvesting sorrel, which is a lettuce, a green, for the 10 salad bars. And they would get like probably two bunches of sorrel and hopefully chop it up and put it in their romaine mix. And that was the contribution, and that was a really wonderful start. We were able to work with the farm after they got some money from the Farm to Schools grant. And they came to us and said, "What, you know, what will it take?" And I said to them, "What it will take is that you guys need to get up to speed on, you know, all of the regulations that we that every other piece of produce has to go through to get into a city school, to any school, you know, to any sort of institution." And so they did a great job and updated all of their equipment for processing. So now they are able to plant, grow, harvest, and process all with the staff overseas students doing this. And they grow us, instead of lots of vegetables for a few amount of schools, they now grow us one or two vegetables for a lot of schools. So as of right now, even in this bitter cold winter, every week 60 city schools gets produce from Great Kids Farm. Right now we're doing a mix of shredded cabbage and carrots and also some shredded beets, which everyone's skeptical if the kids love. But I can tell you, any kid that's been to Great Kids Farm and then sees beets on their salad or their salad bar, they're really excited and they love it and they eat it. So that's where we are right now with city schools. Sorry if I went over. I could talk.
Okay, so questions for Cynthia. Dana, that you've got the mic down that end.
So is there a more formal education program that goes along with the access to the food so that the kids could have some sort of formal idea of why they're eating that food or what the distribution is? And do you think that they can then take that home?
Yes. It's such a great question. And it's actually one of the things I think is really the most, almost the most important piece of the whole program, is that the kids are hearing that message a lot. They're hearing, you know, eat colorful foods, eat, you know, eat your carrots, eat your apples, you know, an apple a day. And a lot of these kids were not given access to that. You know, they couldn't close the loop on that. They were being told to eat carrots, but they never were being offered a carrot. And so I think it's really important now that there it is. It's at lunch, and they're being really encouraged. We also have wonderful partners and are creating more partnerships. One is with Days of Taste that's in schools now. That what we want to do is sort of keep, we're going to work more together because there's lots of people doing lots of, you know, lots of pieces of the puzzle. We're trying to, you know, I'm going to try to be an impetus to put that puzzle together. So if Days of Taste is talking about, you know, we'll just pick beets. So say they're talking about beets, I will then talk to Great Kids Farm about beets and make sure that then beets are part of their lunch to sort of keep that cycle going so that they're getting the message and they have a place to, you know, sort of step up to the plate. And they really do. It's incredible.
I just wanted to pause, just hold your questions for. This is a good segue to introduce Reva Khan, who's with us tonight, and she is the director of the Days of Taste program. And I just wanted to give Reva a few minutes to talk a little bit about Days of Taste, because everybody keeps hearing that phrase, and I just want to explain what it is.
Half the people here are actually part of Days of Taste. And so we collaborate.
I don't even know what it is.
Well, Days of Taste, to give you a one sentence,
a taste.
To give you a one sentence description, Days of Taste is a discovery-based program that brings together professional chefs, farmers, and community volunteers to introduce children to the elements of taste and to help them understand where their food comes from. The overall goal was, I think, best stated by Julia Child, who was our original spokesperson, and this was kind of her dream to have a program like this. We want our kids to know what real food is about, where it came from, and what it's supposed to taste like. And that's really the goal. And so Spike is one of the professional chefs involved. We take our kids to Joan and Drew were the original first 1998 first year farmers that we took our kids to, and so the kids get to taste different foods. They get to compare the tastes. It's very discovery based. They learn from professionals. Those are two big things, and also we focus on taste. So just like Cynthia was saying, I mean. When they get the salad, do they know where that food came from? When they know where it came from, they just saw it on a Great Kids or Drew's Farm, and then they think about how to taste it. And then with the chefs are today's rock stars, it all comes together. They're making their own salad with their friends. I have parents that write to email me afterwards saying, I've been trying to get my kid to eat this, and they haven't. I have kids write back afterwards, I made this for my parents, it's good for my mom's diet, you know. So it's just an amazing thing because it tastes good. They realize this real food, fresh from the farm, really tastes good. And so we go to Baltimore City, Baltimore County, and Howard County right now, and we had about 2,500 kids last year. It's actually part of a national program. And in answer to Barbara's question, some of the cities where it's done, where they have a large farmers market like Dallas or New York that's open all the time, the kids actually go there versus a farm. But I think our kids are the luckiest going to the farm and walking around and getting the opportunity to get in the dirt.
Thank you, Reva. And there was a question behind you, if you want to pick that up and then go right ahead.
One, I think Cynthia is one of the best things that happened to the city school's food and nutrition. And it's made a huge, huge, huge difference in the 4 years, 3 years.
Thank
even though
you.
We don't all miss soup song. My question is, of the 750,000 pounds, is that mm-hmm. the number? How much of that actually gets eaten? Because here's
that's
part
a
of the
good
problem.
Question.
Yes.
So waste is part of the problem, and it's not exclusive to Baltimore City. It is part of the debate over the new requirements, the new federal government requirements requiring children to take an apple or whatever is offered. So the answer to your question is I don't know. The follow-up is we're currently actually working on a what's called a plate waste study, and we're working with a group from the Hopkins School of Public Health. There's a service learning class that is today and tomorrow and Friday tomorrow. They're in cafeterias actually weighing the produce. The focus of this particular plate waste study is sort of back to your question, is are children that have access to other programs, and this one is specifically the students who go to Great Kids Farm and have interaction with the farm within the school, eat more produce. And so we will have that data. And what we're using, you know, we're using that as a data collection. For me and for our office, it's really more, this particular study is really more of a blueprint of how do we do this next year on a bigger scale to really get an answer to that question.
Okay, can I jump in on that?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So I actually just spoke with Liz today. Uh-huh. And so the number is actually 40% from what I know. Mm. But what's really interesting is that number, Baltimore's 40% waste, is consistent mm-hmm. whether schools have more produce or less produce. In your sort of the model where you just offer the food but you don't have to take it, which is what they're trying to roll back right now. They're trying to say, okay, nutrition standards in schools are too strict, the schools are losing money, we're going to roll it back so they don't have to serve as much nutritious food. What we're seeing is that those numbers are, waste is waste, and it's happening in either the school districts, whether they're serving those foods and making them have it, or they're just having it as options.
It's happening in our house.
It's happening. Kids waste food. We don't change policy
right.
because kids are fickle. Kids are fickle. That's what they do. But we don't not offer the food, so that's my bias coming in. But the waste is consistent to everywhere else.
Can I make?
Okay, we had a question.
Can I make a comment? I'm sorry. Can I?
Here, and then we'll let you go.
What's being done so that the children actually cook to bring home ec back? I hear that you're at the farm. I hear that we're serving them. But I think that what would help with the wastage is that the children actually cook. And that's going to be a skill that's going to provide them with a future with this community and with this program as well. So what's actually being done to bring home ec back?
There are a few schools that the Food and Nutrition Office doesn't address that because we address the breakfast and lunch and snack and supper, but we won't go there. But there are actually a few schools that have cooking and culinary programs as part of the curriculum.
Carver.
Right. There's a few vocational high schools.
And
yeah, what's the
Baltimore
name?
Montessori, Hampstead Hills, and it's
Food for Life. Oh yeah, Food for Life is a program that's offered. It's a program that's offered nationally, and two schools in the district offer it. It's part of their curriculum for that exact reason to bring it home. There are I think three or four vocational courses in high schools that are training kids as chefs, and Oh, there's five. Yeah, thank you, Chelle. So that are serious. And Carver High School is one of the really strong ones, and they the kids are, you know, they're doing it as hopefully to transition into a profession, and you know, hopefully that will go home.
So we'll open it up to questions for anyone at this point. So I see one down that end, and then I'm coming to you.
Drew or Joan, how does having your son come into the business allow the farm to potentially move on to another generation and get involved with these programs that are just starting now?
Oh, you'll like this one. So you heard that the very first days of Taste was at our farm. Well, I got this permission slip home one day asking for my son to come to this field trip at One Star Farm. So Andrew was actually one of the very first Days of Taste program members. So if you're considering success 15 years later, he now wants to be a farmer, I would say that's a successful program. What's happening is we're having to expand. So we're now growing pork. We're looking into growing other protein sources. We brought another piece of property that we're talking about, quote, farming in the woods. And so we're looking for other opportunities to kind of broaden our base to support another family member farming. But I want to make a comment before we go too much further.
Uh-huh.
One is I think these programs, what they're creating is, in my personal opinion, it is not education that makes a child want to eat a piece of vegetable or eat a vegetable or a piece of fruit. It is about desire. You have to want to do it. So once you have this little bit of information, it doesn't matter if you like it or you learned it was good for you. It's about somebody else ate it, whether it's a rock star chef who told you it was a cool thing and you think, okay, I'll try it. But there's this desire piece that's completely different from education. Because we all know that it's all good for us, and all of us probably ate something this week that we shouldn't and should have had an apple instead. And as far as waste is concerned, I went to a meeting years ago, and there was a farmer there saying, he had an orchard, and he said, you know, for years and years I took my little tiny number 100 or 120 apples, which are the size of like a large marble, and he said, I would put them in and make cider with them. And somehow he started working with the school system. If you're 6 years old, an apple that's an apple that you and I would eat is enough for them for about 2 weeks. But by selling very small apples to kids in first grade that are their size, because a kid's stomach is the size of their fist. So if you start thinking about this waste, I would tell you, I think you're feeding them too much. And you're making that a big upper, you know, plate for a little tiny, you know, sixth grader. No wonder they're throwing away 40%. If they eat 60% of it, I think they're doing pretty darn good.
Okay, here we go.
Well, first I want to say I'm so impressed by everything I hear. I don't live in Baltimore. I live in Annapolis. It makes me want to move to Baltimore. I have a question, though. I eat a lot of produce. I believe that food is medicine. But I spend a lot of money on food. I think cooking from scratch costs me more money. So I wonder about, you know, how do kids, they get a taste for it. I think if you taste something fresh, you appreciate, you start to develop a palate for it. Mm-hmm. But in taking it home, their parents have to be able to shop that way. And I think I spend more buying good food, you know, good fruits and vegetables than if I bought a lot of packages and grains. And, I wonder your thoughts about how do we overcome that challenge.
Thank you. That's a great question. Who would like to take a stab
at that? I'm going to take it from the policy side. So there's a couple key things. I mean, there's some analysis that we're doing here in the city and also watching nationally. So one thing we know is that the cost of produce in season, if you're buying it from a local farm, say at a farmer's market, is consistent to other grocery stores. Now, that's not saying that produce is not expensive. We're just saying that local produce may not be more expensive than other produce. But that is where we have to think about policy and what programs are in place for those who are low income. And so there's a couple key things. I'm just going to talk really about the innovations. Is SNAP. At the farmer's market, you can use your independence card. But now we have a program for the last 3 years. It's double incentive dollars. It's Maryland market money. You spend $10, excuse me, you get $10 more for produce. So we can extend. And so what we're actually really trying to do is we know that most people will use up their SNAP in 14 days because it's just not enough money. And so use it and then spend that extra money that you got for your incentives at the end of the month when you wouldn't normally eat your produce. And that's one idea. It's like, how do you extend your SNAP so that you could eat produce? So the farmers markets, I think we have many farmers markets in the city now has SNAP. Then let's talk about WIC. So WIC, you're all probably familiar with WIC. It's Women, Infant, Children. It's a supplemental program. It's not based on money, unlike SNAP. So a low-income mother will go buy produce. Their voucher is for $8 of produce, but it's produce. They don't. It doesn't translate as money. So in that way, that if you're on WIC, you really have a great opportunity to be able to eat fresh if you are educated and make those choices. So WIC is, and there's also incentive dollars for WIC. So if you spend your WIC money, you can get more on produce. So those are just a couple ideas on how you extend the federal nutrition assistance to be able to get produce.
Is there a question down there, Dana? Let's see.
Comment and a question. That federal level, of course, you're asking about the cost of produce. I mean, bad food is massively subsidized by the federal government to the tune of uncountable billions of dollars. Nobody at this table can fix that. But the question is, off of Monroe Street, west of here, there's a couple of blocks of row houses that have been demolished and are now look like they're being farmed. They're covered with plastic tarps to create a greenhouse. And I'm wondering if any of the programs that you're talking about are involved with converting some of the abandoned or decrepit housing into farmable land.
That's me. Yes. So I actually have to look at my notes in a second, but I'll tell you what I know off the top of my head. So we have the Land Leasing Initiative. It's with vacant land. And so farmers are starting to farm vacant land and the hoop houses. We changed the building code. And by changing the building code, we went from one illegal hoop house that we had to close our eyes every time we passed it to now we have 45 or 50 hoop houses in the city. So we're really actually wanting to see that happen.
Who paid for demolishing?
All right, so that brings me to my second point. So my second point is the city is really looking at its vacants to value program. And how do we change our vacants in the city? And so there's this whole Growing Green initiative where we have what's called a pattern book. And so we're actually doing deconstruction for greening space in the city. Not everywhere, but there's certain areas we're saying, okay, let's take down these areas because we already have deconstruction money. And then it's like, what's the best use for this vacant land? Should it be for a park? Should it be for a farm? Should it be for a retail establishment? And there's actually a sort of a pattern book that developers and planning is using to be able to see some growing of food in the city as well.
So there's some land for the young farmer down here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a land leasing initiative for the city. It's free land for farmers to grow food for production.
Okay, looks like we have a couple down your way, Dana.
Go ahead. Well, I guess I'm completely impressed and I'm completely overwhelmed. It seems that we're talking about some kind of mixed system where we supply somewhere within a 200-mile radius, we supply enough local produce, we feed everybody in a healthy way, and then we deal with everything that they won't eat. And we're guided by federal rules, or mandated by federal rules. Who's like guiding this system? But who's developing what to do with the waste? How does this thing move forward? What percentage of local food is actually being brought into the Baltimore City system? And then use, and does that go way up and down, or are they mandated to do a certain percentage?
No, there are produce purveyors, Coastal Sunbelt, which if anyone's driving around town, you'll see their blue trucks all over. And I wish I had more of a breakdown for you, but I will tell you it's sort of our. Sort of one of the irritating parts of my job is that in the time of year where produce is growing abundantly very close to town, there's only, it's summer, and there's only 35 to 40 sites. So that's sort of, it's really hard. But when we go back to school, one of the things that I do, and this is sort of where my restaurant background comes in, is that each of our cafeteria managers orders their own food. So they know their students, someone was talking about, like, you know, if it's cool to eat it, kids will eat it, and or anyone will eat it. And it's true. I have some schools that go through, you know, 7 cases of cucumbers a week, and another school goes through 10 cases of cherry tomatoes in a week. And I think it's all because the cool kids eat the cucumbers and at one school, and then they eat the... And so we give the cafeteria managers the freedom to order their own produce. What I do on my end to try to reduce waste and encourage more local is within our computer system, I limit what they are allowed to order. So, for example, I think the best example is that when it is back to school in late August and September, they're not able to order apples and oranges and pears. They are only able to order peaches, plums, nectarines, and watermelons, I mean, which is amazing. And I still, today, you know, had one cafeteria manager call me and say, can I order plums? I've been trying to order plums, and I still can't get them. My kids love the plums. And I'm like, well, you can't get them. So that's part of the training component. But so on the produce side, you know, I try to take my chef background and control it as much as I can there. It, you know, I get a lot of pushback from it. I mean, people want, they see strawberries at the Safeway, they want strawberries, and I don't allow it, and it's a little up for debate. But that's one of the ways we try to combat the waste. The other way that's very much in the near future is just more and more and more training of our staff, and not only increasing the appeal and the health benefits and the you know, the quality of what we're serving, it's the quality of how we're serving it. And the district is, you know, in my office, there's people doing lots of, you know, studies and cost analysis of, you know, different ways to serve the food. Serving something on styrofoam, not the ideal, but, you know, what can we do? That's a long-term solution. One of the things that I think plagues big institutions like any food and nutrition in a big city is short-term solutions. Like, don't like styrofoam? Get biodegradable. But okay, but, you know, then what happens when, you know, a new kitchen is installed and, you know, they want plastic trays and, you know, so we're really trying to make long-term wise decisions. And so that's the focus right now, is really increasing, you know, the cafeteria environment.
Yes.
Holly, I'm intrigued by the sheep of Cleveland. What can we do with livestock in Baltimore?
All right. So actually, I forgot to say something that was really exciting. I want to tell you something. So I was having this conversation with someone at the health department a few years ago, and they're like, oh, I have to get back to my office because I'm working on the final animal regs. I said, what? What are you working on? And she's like, the animal regs. I said, you mean chickens? You mean miniature goats? You mean animal regs? She said, yeah, I'm finishing it up right now for the health commissioner. I said, can you give me 24 hours? Can we draft up, you know, what we would like to see for animal regs in the city? And this is kind of like one of the hidden secrets, and I'm getting recorded. And ever since that day, I realized I love regs. Regs go through, like, the health commissioner. A regulation is something that a few people has to go through public comment, but it doesn't go through 5 years of comments. And so we now have up to 10 chickens, just so you know, based on size. This happened, like, overnight. But now if you are a real food farm or a farm in the city and you have space, you can have more chickens. So we now allow for chickens. We allow for miniature goats. I forgot sheep. I regret that. I forgot sheep. But I got the chickens. I think I have to look at my notes. But we have a nice array of small livestock allowed in our city, except for sheep. We'll get back to that one. And so that doesn't mean we're having huge grazing going on. And I think that it is definitely within our reach to do that. But we do have really good animal regs. I mean, Seattle tried to get chickens for like 5 years. We did it in like 24 hours, 48 hours.
We get a lot of deer.
We do get a lot of deer. So.
Feed that to the school kid.
Locally sourced. You could solve so many economic problems in the city. You could solve so many problems with local source. And to ask the policy maker, director, I think it was 84,000 kids in Baltimore City's schools. You know, you tie in all the institutions such as Hopkins, who seem to be doing a really good job of trying to locally source. That what are you doing in your office in terms of trying to get locally sourced regulations?
So there's a few things. One is when you look at, the first question is, how much food does the city actually control in procurement? And so I have the answer to that. That took me a little bit of time to get that answer. So the first answer is, the Baltimore City does not run Baltimore City Schools. That's Baltimore City Schools. So when you go, okay, if you take all the kids out of the picture, who do we really feed, and what is our procurement contract? So here's the answer. It's summer meals in the summer run through our housing program, and that is a very, very large contract. And then it is our senior program for the aging. That's the senior meals program. That's another relatively large contract. And then, so those are two of my targets. And the third one, I'm not 100% sure. I'm pretty sure prisons come into play as well. And so then I have to look at this from a triage approach. Because remember, my job is twofold. Food access, local food. They don't always match. Sometimes they match. So I have to say, when I'm looking at summer meals right now, I am just trying to get that quality up. And I'm trying to get more produce in it. And the amount of money they're negotiating right now for that is, I hope to get some local food procurement in the RFPs, and we're trying to get some language. But right now, I'm trying to get the partners in place to get that food so the kids really want to eat it. And so we're starting with the procurement and the language. I do want to see locally sourced. Locally sourced is going to have to come from the region. It's not coming from Baltimore City when we're dealing with large institutions. So those are the two contracts that are coming up for renewal. That we're looking at how do we put language, procurement languages. Now, there are other cities. I think San Francisco is a great model, and other cities that have these mandates. 20% of the city's procurement needs to come from local. It's really great to have that target, but when you look at the actual numbers, they're not getting met. And so I'm not sure if the answer is to make it so that we get towards that goal. And so that's what we're really looking at, is should we have this mandate of percentage, or do we really look at a contract to contract and try to get it up as much as we can? And I think the institutions, like with the schools and Johns Hopkins and the facilities where they have a produce distributor, where a lot of these are not, it's a meal being served where a tiny portion of it is coming from produce, and then that tiny piece you're trying to get for local. So it's a complicated question. We definitely have our eyes on it. And that's something I would like to see. We're going to be revising our sustainability plan in the next year or so, and I would like to see specific language on local food procurement. It has not been something that we have specifically targeted out, and I think it is something we need to target so we start to address it.
Okay, I have one down here.
So to complete the circle, other than teaching them to cook, I'm also interested if anybody has any information on hives. Are there any bees or seeds that are preserved that are locally sourced as well?
Local bees.
Did you say bees?
Yes.
So they're in our regs I just talked about.
With the, along with the chickens?
Little tiny lifestyle.
Okay. So were you going to answer that, Joe?
Mars has bees.
Yeah, there's a bees club.
There's quite a bit.
Yeah, there's quite a bit of bees.
Hivery going on, apiary, whatever the word is.
There's the
microphone, hold on.
There is someone who's promoting hives in the city, and I forget what she calls.
And I think Real Food Farm has
something. Yeah, there's a bee association. I don't remember the name right now, but there's a bee association, and they go to people's yard and other places in the city, and they will use the land to raise bees. So actually, I think there is quite a bit of bees happening in our city right now.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Two questions. What is being done about the food desert problem that we're having? What's being done about the food desert in the city? And then I had a question about what percent of the farm land is being used for produce versus subsidized fuel crops.
Okay, so I would say 85 to 90% of my time is really on the food access, food desert issue. We understand our food environment very, very well. And so what we know, approximately 25% of Baltimore City residents live in food deserts. We know that kids are really one of the highest group of people being affected by food access in our city. What we understand about food access is that there is no one solution. So we are looking at this from a, we have a food desert retail strategy, and we are looking at how do we attract grocery stores in the city. We're working right now on a seed enabling legislation and local city council legislation to be able to attract grocery stores by personal property tax, make it more affordable for grocery stores to come in. Also, our existing stores, we want to make sure that they can be able to expand and renovate, so that would apply to them. So we have sort of a whole supermarket attraction and retention strategy, and that's one piece. Then we have to pay attention to the fact that we have a ton of corner stores and a ton of carryouts, and they are here. They are brick and mortars. Can we get them to be able to be more like small grocery stores? Can they be having healthier foods? We have a healthy corner store program. But there's, I look at a lot of the policy stuff. There's a federal policy change coming down the pike in the next year that's mandating corner stores, if they want to accept SNAP, they have to have more like a mini grocery store model. And so we're trying to get the stores ready. Right. So
a corner... vendors also, right? I mean,
so...
vendors that they have to provide...
They do, but it gets complicated because, like, when we try to get one of these stores, they got a produce container and it fell to the floor. So it's not just about, like, getting the produce, you know, refrigeration in, but, like, the building itself has to be stable. And some of the things that you think would be so simple, or, I mean, the floor really did fall through. And this is not – it's different. Philly had the same problem. Like, I keep talking to all these other cities who have the same exact problem. So you look at the corner stores – then you have, I mean, you have to look at the farmers markets. A lot of these things, you have to look at many different strategies, the farmers markets. Then you look at who are our partners, how can they partner in around education to change the food. One of the problems we have is the stores start to sell healthy, a corner store, but no one buys it, and the timing is mismatched. And so those are, I can talk to you at length on this. I spent a lot of time on this issue. And we'll be releasing our new maps. And one of the things that we try to do is, we have been mapping our food environment not only by the city, but now we'll be releasing council district maps. And so we're understanding it from retail, but also by our food assistants. You know, how does our food assistance look? Is it consistent? In food deserts, why is there some pockets where there are no summer meals? I mean, it's a food desert. Or why is that there's a food bank over here, but there's not one over here, but there's a grocery store here? And so we're mapping it in a level that we can start to ask the appropriate questions for solutions.
Okay, we've got another question.
So I guess I have a question more for Joan and Drew, because I feel like we get to hear a lot about the challenges of getting this food into schools or into different city programs from the side of the city program or from the school system. But, I mean, we have the farmers who are here growing the produce, and I guess I'm wondering, from your point of view, like, what is hard about getting it in? Like, it would seem superficially that having an account or a customer as large as... any one of these programs would be really appealing, and I know that it might not be, and so I guess I'm wondering what makes it difficult for the farmers to get the food into these places.
To get it into the school system, I went to a meeting years ago where they asked, and they sent us one of those city things that's a bunch of papers, it was about 45 pages long, and then they had asked me to send them a check in case I didn't show up with produce one day for $3,000. And if I didn't show up with the tomatoes on the day that I said I would bring them, they were going to take the money out of my $3,000 to go buy them somewhere else. So needless to say, I told them no. You know, I'm not going to do that. I said, if I'm told you I'm going to bring them to you, I will bring them to you. If I don't have them, I don't have them. They're like, well, you might sell them to somebody else before us. Not if I said I was going to do it, I have my honor. Well, no, that's how we do it in the city. And I said, well, you'll do business with somebody else. But since then, years ago we sold to Coastal Sunbelt. We had kind of gotten off the wholesale market as we developed our CSA and restaurant business. And just this winter, I had met with Coastal Sunbelt at a different conference, and he said, we need to talk some more. So we're actually going back to him in the near future to talk about selling and getting it back into the school system and being on that list so that I don't have to deal directly with the city. I can kind of circumvent it and go back through, you know, a wholesaler again. It's... ideally, it would be cheaper for the city if I sold directly to them, but at this point, it's not going to work. I can't drop off one case of tomatoes at, you know, 67 different stores where I can take 67 cases to one place. So that's a difficulty for me.
So a food hub. We really need to see local food aggregation in the city. Because one of the issues is that when you look at institutional market share, you need a wholesaler right now because there's no one aggregating our product. And so that's one of the things that we need to work on is how do we get local food aggregation into the city. You know, we're looking at some partners in Philly and other folks who are already doing it. Can they be distributing here? Can we create the systems? It doesn't solve the big picture, but I think transportation, you would probably say, is a big one. And
big.
When you also say, you know, a lot of your barriers are coming from USDA as far as ag production or organic standards. Like, I mean, I think there's policy, and maybe it's not you, Joan, but other farms, that there's mandates and inspections and certain things you have to do that don't always apply to the small farmer. That makes it harder for, like, the institutions we are mandating that it has to be a certain way, but a small farmer doesn't have that capacity.
At one point, we had it was our local county school, and they were selling French fries at the football game. And so it was a county school, not a city one. And I said, you know, we have all these sweet potatoes. How about we cut them up and we'll sell the sweet potatoes from me? I'll donate it, and you can give half the money to the Future Farmers of America and the other half to the football team. And someone said to me, oh, you can't do that. I said, why not? They said, you have to be certified. And I said, oh, don't worry, I'm certified organic. You know, that's a federal mandate through the state of Maryland. I figured I had everything covered. They said, oh, no, you have to be certified by Cisco. I figured I was probably barking up the wrong tree at that point.
So, Dana, are we ready to wrap up? One more question?
One more question.
Okay.
I have a question that's a little bit sort of off of what we've been talking about. How do you decide what to grow?
Because I have a wish list that I tell him, and then he says no to several things.
But does Spike have a wish list that affects what you
yes.
grow?
Yes. It probably doesn't affect it. He has given us, we have, you know, things that we grow that he wants us to grow for him, and some things are contracts that, you know, he wants us to grow something specifically for him. We have a few restaurants who do a few of that, but generally there's would be his job to choose.
We just grow what I know I can produce economically here. We pretty much grow everything you can think of. I mean, there's some things that I don't do well. We have a hard time raising carrots because of our soil type. We have a hard time raising celery because of our climate. So it's soil type and climate sort of determines what I can grow here.
Rather than what people are asking for.
Well, I mean, I've mentioned two vegetable items at this point that I can't grow.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, we don't grow bananas. We don't grow lemons and limes. I answer that question a lot, so that's...
You know, I don't have tomatoes in November, and I don't have tomatoes in June. So I'm what I grow is determined by climate and soil.
Yeah, okay.
Well, we can... One more
question, okay. And then we'll wrap it up.
Would you expand a little bit on the kids' farm? On how big that is, and is
it running great kids' farm?
There's actually
who is the kids' farm?
Sure, it is part of Baltimore City Public Schools. Another woman here, Chella Cooper, is the chef at Great Kids Farm, and I think she can give a little answer than I can.
Great Kids Farm is a 33-acre farm located in Catonsville, Maryland. It's actually a school with Baltimore City Public Schools, school number 775. Of the 33 acres, we have about 11 acres that's woodlands with a stream that's right up against Patapsco State Park. We have an orchard that's about an acre and a half. We have a far field that's probably 1.5 to 2 acres. And then we have our upper campus, which is cultivated specifically for educational purposes for the students who come out to the farm and the students who work at the farm. We have a couple hoop houses, a greenhouse, where we do grow about 5% of our crops that go to restaurants, including Spike's restaurants. And the work that we do at the farm that has to do with the actual farming is done by our student interns. So there are only 4 city schools employees that work at the farm. There's a farmer, a teacher, a chef, that's me, and a custodian. And with the 4 of us, we're able to leverage reaching out to 4,000 students who come to the farm every year, who are city school students. We grow the food that goes into right now 60 of the school salad bars or cafeteria lines. We reach out to schools with things that include seeds, seedlings,
We partnered with one of the high schools that has a carpentry shop, so the students could build schoolyard gardens. Chesapeake Compost provided the safe soil to be able to grow the food at the, literally at the schools on the site. Even if all they have is a patch of concrete, they can put the, you know, basically IKEA-style kit on top of it. We give them the seeds and the seedlings, and then it's let them go. So during the year when we bring the kids out to the farm, we teach them and the teachers through a variety of programs how to grow the food that we're growing at the farm, so that when they see it at the salad bars, they say, oh, I've seen that at the, and so that in sort of instills this excitement and enthusiasm when they go into the salad bars. So the thing that Cynthia was saying about the beets, I've been at the farm for a year and a half, and when I first showed up, they had just harvested like 1,800 pounds of beets, and it was my job to process it to get to the salad bars. And I was like, you're kidding me, beets. And you wouldn't believe it. The students that we had come out during the fall, we had them do each group that came out, we did taste testing with them as part of their farm experience. And then they kept coming back saying, when are we getting beets? When are we going to see the beets? And the sorrel that Cynthia talked about going into those 10 salad bars like 6 years ago, we still have students who get off the bus and the first thing they go to is the demonstration garden where you have sorrel growing. And they'll be like, wait, where are you kids going? We're just going to go pick some sorrel. And you want to be like, well, you got to stay with your school group, but go eat those vegetables, sure. So that's great kids farm. It's been around for about 7 years with the school district. And yep.
I love that hopeful way to end. That was like perfect. So thank you.
Thanks again for joining us tonight at Artifacts for our Origin Speaker Series. With thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Lou Mann, Mark Eldridge, Dennis Greensfelder, and Dakota Keaton from the Broadcasting Institute of Maryland for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.